WBI 99.5 FM. We in the Rebel Mix. That was a Rebel Mix with DJ Fred Ones. We got some special guests. We're going to have a little last minute freestyle before we get up out of here. Last minute announcement as well. We hope to see y'all out Friday, July 15th at 6:30 p.m. at the Malcolm X and Dr. Betty Shabazz Center for Imprisoned Resistance, the Politics of Incarceration in Palestine and the U.S. Speakers, Mumia Abu-Jamal, Laura Whitehorn, Nancy Mansour, Joanna Fernandez. That's this Friday, July 15th, 6:30 p.m. in Harlem at the Dr. Betty Shabazz Center. We also invite you this Sunday, July 17th, 4 p.m. at Hunts Point Plaza. There will be a Stop the Violence rally. When we talk about violence, we talk about poverty is violence, unemployment is violence, broken windows policing is violence. 4 p.m. Hunts Point Plaza. A lot of folks talk about marching in the city. We're going to be marching in the hood. We're going to get this over real quick. We got the brother Marv G. You know what I'm saying? Represent Kumbalings, represent Chicago. He going to get this little freestyle out before we get off the air. This is Rebel Diaz Radio. We are tuned in. 99.5 FM. Peace out, y'all. We're going to get out of here with this freestyle piece.
Let's go.
But now represent Kumbalings, Marv G. Chicago.
Milo. Marv G. Kumbalings, Uptown in the place to be. What's bragging? Times have changed. What's good, G? What? What's happening, Rebel Diaz? WBAI 99.5 FM. Let's get it. Saki in a bucket of muscles, bucket hat on the head, that's the helmet for the hustle. Russell with the upper echelons, dons and mafiosos, put the hit out if you local, my locals, plenty resourceful with levels. Rebel soldiers with me, only with the potent, the mother imposter, so-so, and that's why she feel my mojo, poaching furs, things that purr, this cheetah cost about a bird, ain't flipping chicks on stoves, but I handle herbs, season your ear with plenty flavor. Believe the hype and tell your neighbor, hunting every season, laser beams, do yourself a favor, stay out the range of the target, this ain't a threat, don't get tarnished, ninja goons at night, round the house like Chuck Norris, body in the DeLorean, leave you in the forest, wake up in the morning like nothing happened and eat some porridge, natural that my performance endorsing her endorphins, natural that my performance endorsing her endorphins,
keep it going live, y'all, that's Rebel Diaz Radio, one love, y'all, New York City, that was Marv G, Rod Stars G1, John Mega, Rebel Diaz Radio, let's go.
Join us August 13th for the Liquid Sound Lounge annual Summer Soulful House Music Boat Dance Party. Taking it to the waters with yours truly, DJ Jeannie Hopper on the decks, and guest Kim Lightfoot, as well as Jay Rodriguez live on sax and flute, aboard the Cabana, East 23rd Street Marina, off the East River in Manhattan. 11 p.m. boarding, departing at midnight, returning at 3 a.m. Proceeds go to support listener-sponsored non-commercial community radio, WBAI. For tickets and further information, go to brownpapertickets.com and search Liquid Sound Lounge. All aboard, August 13th.
My name is Kofi, and I'm an intern at WBAI to help ensure that the station will continue to inform, entertain, and educate the listeners in a unique and critical view on politics, art, music, literature, health, and culture. Please support our upcoming summer fun drive. What makes WBAI unique from most radio stations is that most of all funding for the station is from you, the listeners. So you can definitely have an impact on the well-being of the station beyond being a loyal listener. Just by donating $25, you can become a member of WBAI and be eligible to vote in the local station board. The fun drive begins on Monday, July 18th, and the phone number to call in is 516-620-3602. Or give to, that's the number to, WBAI.org.
Members of two recent delegations to Palestine a prison labor and academic delegation, and a Dream Defender delegation will report on what they saw and heard, and how it echoes current repression and current struggles for justice here. Join us on Friday, July 15th, 6:30 p.m. at the Malcolm X and Dr. Betty Shabazz Center, 3940 Broadway at 165th Street, for a discussion of how the U.S. and Israel use incarceration to contain and dismantle resistance, and how we can push back and support the boycott movement. For more information, call 347-709-2264 or email bringmumiahome@gmail.com.
Bathing in the warmth of the morning sun. And I would love to say good morning. You're listening to WBAI in New York City, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. This program is Heart of Mind, Earth at Midnight. I'm Catherine Davis, your host, and I'm very happy to be with you here this morning, live in studio. Unfortunately, we still do not have call-in phones, so we're just a bit disconnected, other than our usual ability to talk with each other. Of course, if you have a thought you'd like to share, or a comment, or a question, you can send to heartofmindradio@gmail.com. I have my email open, so if you did send something in, I'd be able to read it and respond on the air. On today's show, we're going to have some interesting bits to share with you. And I thought I would start out with a little bit by Greg Braden. Some of you know of Greg Braden, and he is a best-selling author and independent researcher, and he explores the potential for dramatic shift in human consciousness that may already be well underway. And in this particular little clip, I'm just going to play a little bit, Greg discusses a universal impulse that he has found in the lives of people all over the world, the sense that something is awakening deep within that will radically change our view of the world and our role in it. So this is not a new clip, but it's kind of interesting in that I really see the fruit of what he was speaking of, because in fact, we really are living in a very different world nowadays than I certainly would have imagined, with the campaigns and activism taking place in the world. The Black Lives Matter movement, a few years ago, the Occupy Wall Street movement. And I just really think that we are in for a tremendous amount of change, but within that is also a deeply inspired change that happens within each of us. So let's hear a little of what Greg Braden has to say this morning. Whoops, that was nice, but not quite what I was looking for.
How many of you feel like something is happening now that perhaps is very unique, very different from what we've known in the past in our lives? Do you feel like something's about to happen? We have the rare opportunity, my wife and I, to journey throughout this country as well as the rest of the world. And we've found this phenomenon, this common thread that runs in the belief systems of people from the tiniest villages in the mountains of Peru to the small towns along the Nile in Egypt, into the monasteries at 15,000 feet in the Himalayan mountains, and to the neighbors right next door to us in northern New Mexico. Everyone feels that something is different now. Something big is about to happen. There are differences in terms of how they interpret that sense. For some of them, it's just this low-level anxiety. They feel like something is churning deep within, ancient memories coming forth. Many people feel that the lives they've created for themselves meticulously, the educational parameters, their vocations, their friends and support systems no longer make sense, and they're struggling to understand what that's all about. And for others, what they've found is something has awakened from deep within them. And in that awakening, they have taken on a new worldview of themselves and their relationship to one another. in this time in history. Well, this is interesting because our own science now has begun to measure and document unprecedented phenomenon, many, many levels that we've never seen in recorded human, and in some cases even geologic history. Something is happening now, something unique. One of the reasons in the West that it may make little sense to us is because 1,700 years ago, something happened that forever changed the way that we view our relationship to one another and the creative forces of our world. 1,700 years ago, there were tremendous amounts of information taken from our documents, the history of our world, and from that time forward, we have interpreted what it is that we witness in our world, the phenomenon in our natural world and in our interpersonal relationships through the eyes of our direct experience. We lost the context, we lost the framework within which to place these experiences and these situations. As we are coming to the completion of this time in history, this grand cycle of experience, the close of this decade, the close of this century, the shift of the millennium, all this information now is coming back to us, and it's becoming much clearer why in the West we have witnessed and viewed with mystery so much of the phenomenon that we're seeing, while the rest of the world, their traditions and their belief systems, they not only allow for the kinds of changes we're seeing in our world, they expect it, and they know that it's part of something even greater. I'd like to share with you some of the information as our own science is witnessing unprecedented phenomenon. Things are happening now we've never seen before. They're a mystery to the West because we lost the context. In other traditions, not only do these events make sense, they indicate that there's a timetable unfolding and that this timetable is intact as we are converging on this point in history. The ancients called the shift of the ages. Our own science now, within the last few years, in 1991, I'll share a little story with you. It sounds almost like the plot of a science fiction movie that we saw recently, and maybe this is where these plots come from. In 1991, from the center of our own Milky Way galaxy, through an array of telescopes in Socorro, New Mexico, in northern New Mexico, one evening they picked up a signal coming from space that we'd never heard before. And it was a signal that was coming from the center of our Milky Way galaxy. That signal continues to this day. And researchers, it's a mystery. They say, why is this happening now? The University of Albuquerque is where they first began sharing the information. And what they actually said was that a source of fluctuating radio frequency emission suddenly appeared near the center of our Milky Way, has astronomers baffled. So they're still investigating this today. Why did that happen in 1991? Earth now is being bathed in a radio frequency signal that we've never seen before. What does that mean, and why is it happening now? Throughout our solar system, we are witnessing phenomenon unprecedented in modern physics and modern astronomy. Things are happening in the outer planets our physics really doesn't account for. For example, our sun is cooling down on the one hand, and on the other hand, the temperatures inside of the outer planets is increasing. If their heat source is the radiant energy from our sun and our sun's cooling, our physics doesn't allow for these planets to heat up while the sun's cooling down. What's happening? Why is that happening now? Our own sun has been the source of a lot of controversy. The tech journals now, if you're following the tech journals, have a tremendous amount of information that has not made it into mainstream publications such as Time Magazine maybe, or Look, or Newsweek. Amazing phenomenon occurring on our sun. We really began to see some of these phenomenon in 1996. We sent a spacecraft, it was called the Ulysses spacecraft, to the sun to document what we believe were the magnetic fields of the sun at that time. It took a few months to get there. In late 1996, what Ulysses said to us, the signals that it sent back, it said that the magnetic fields of the South Pole were almost non-existent. They were barely discernible. And a few months later, Ulysses went to the equator and found that the measurements of magnetics at the equator were the same as they were at the South Pole. In early 97, at the North Pole of the Sun, Ulysses found the same thing. What had happened is that the composite magnetics of the Sun have dropped to such a low level, there really is no North or South Pole on the Sun any longer, and researchers essentially say that the magnetic field of the Sun now is null. We have many small magnetic fields throughout the Sun rather than one global north and south in the Sun. Why is this happening now? Why aren't we hearing more about it? The solar flares in our Sun, we're seeing unprecedented levels of solar flares, and some of this data is so new. I'd like to just update you and share with you some of this information. Beginning in 1989, we began seeing solar flares on the Sun that we'd never seen before from the Solar Max satellite. And what was happening was we saw the largest solar flares ever observed. The satellite's hard X-ray burst spectrometer recorded 447 hard X-ray flares, a rate of about 32 per day. We used to see maybe 32 in a 30-day period. Well, there is a parameter called PFU, proton flux units. This is a measure of energy coming from the Sun 93 million miles across space to Earth. It's just a measure of that energy. And the proton flux units are being measured on levels of magnitudes greater than anything we've ever seen before. And I'd just like to share some of these with you. Back in 1975, 1976, proton flux units were measured at around 12 proton flux units, something like that, 12, 20, somewhere in that magnitude. And that was the average for that time. In 1978, something happened, and those numbers increased to between 1,000 and 2,200. 1982, we saw 2,900. In 1989, something happened that sent these scales right off of the charts. We went from 22 and 2,900 proton flux units to over 40,000. And then later in 1993, 43,000 proton flux units. What in the world is going on? In 1998, June and early July, something happened we've never seen before. Two comets struck our Sun at the same time. And they began creating solar events at the rate exceeding anything that we'd seen before in terms of the number of flares per day, 40, 45, 50 flares per day. We've never seen that. And it's very interesting, as we download this information from the research facilities, they are sharing the information all the way up to May of 1998, it's conspicuously absent for June and July during these solar events. They're still working through the data, and then they pick it up again in August. And in August of this year, we're back very close to where we have been in the past. The Sun is going through a solar cycle, apparently, that lasts 11 years, and we're in the 10th year. That solar cycle will culminate in the year 2000. Very interesting, along with many of the other phenomena that are converging on this point.
Thank you. seen the glory of a brighter sun. My heart aches, it has felt the peace of perfect love. My mind fails as I try to recall the bliss of a glorious day when I was sleeping, eyes wide open, dreaming. Answer all my prayers. Where are you from, angel? You saved my life and disappeared. How do I find you? Will you come when I need you? Oh, how I'd love to be sleeping, eyes wide open, dreaming.
Welcome back, and that was Dreaming Wide Awake, a lovely piece, and by Liz Wright. Our opening song is Michelle Indiocello and Earth, and we heard a little piece by Greg Braden talking about the shift of the ages, just to give a little taste of understanding that there's really something going on beyond the woo-woo spiritual idea that the ages are shifting. There are really measurable changes that have been taking place that, you know, can be researched, can be looked at, and can be wondered about in terms of what's really going on. So I thought that that would be quite a useful thing for us to do. And coming up, we're going to return to our ongoing readings from the book Ishmael. And we're being joined by Matt Mazza. So, hello, Matt.
Well, good evening. Good evening to our listeners. Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you. So, for people who may not have heard the first installment, tell us a little bit about Ishmael. Well, actually, before you start, I realize I need to offer an announcement because there was a change of information, and I want to make sure people have that. I've had on the program a couple of times the Earth Center, which is a traditional school of Kemet and culture of the motherland, and they are having a series of graduations and initiation, and the dates have been changed. So if you're familiar with the Earth Center, you can go to their website, theearthcenter.org, and their graduations will be on July 23rd and August 6th, and the time will be from 3 to 5 p.m. They have an orientation, which you can find out about the various programs that they have, and that's on August 7th. and that will be from 5 p.m. till 8 p.m. The address is 137-42 Guy R. Brewer Boulevard in Jamaica. And for information, you can call either of these two numbers, 347-529-1399, or you can call 917-387-8300. And their website is theearthcenter.org. And they have programs in natural healing, understanding the healing technologies. They have classes in language, learning Medu, which is the language of the hieroglyphs. And they have classes in Ka'atibi, which is a form of energy meditation. It's an initiation, so it's not quite a class, but you can check out by those sources of information. Or if you didn't catch it all, you may send an email to me at heartofmindradio@gmail.com. And with that interruption out of the way, Matt, tell us a little bit about Ishmael.
Well, this is a very, very interesting story. I guess the author has a certain perspective on where we are going with our technological advances. He raises the issue of we may be making progress, but at the same time, we are going towards extinction. As a result, what with pollution and nuclear waste, etc., etc. The story starts with a young man who is a bit jaded. You know, he's a little bit cynical. He thought when he was younger he was going to save the world, but that's poppycock to him now. But he comes upon an ad put out by a teacher. Young man, a student wanted, must have a sincere desire to save the world. And he's thinking to himself, yeah, right. And he puts the newspaper in the garbage. Later, something wakes up with him and he says, let me look at that again. Well, maybe I'll go down there and I'll look at it and I'll just see the look of the room and the look of this guy and I'll know right away to turn around and walk out. So, eventually he goes to the place of the ad to meet the teacher. He walks into what appears to be an empty room. And he looks around. And he sees a glass enclosure. And he looks. And inside is a gorilla. And he makes eye contact. And this turns out to be the teacher. So, as it appears on some telepathic level, they are going to communicate. And this teacher is going to impart certain knowledge to him. And thus the story goes. And the gorilla, his name is Ishmael. And how he gets that name, well, somebody took him in, gave him a home, brought him from a zoo or something. They didn't want him. And the master says he was originally called Goliath. But the master says, you are not Goliath, he says. At that, he turned and marched back the way he'd come, without a look to right or left. So we continue. Subchapter 4 on page 16. The protagonist, who is not named in this story, interestingly enough, that seems to be not necessary. I was thunderstruck, as you may well imagine. not Goliath. What could it possibly mean to be not Goliath? It didn't occur to me to say, well, if I'm not Goliath, then who am I? A human would ask this question because he would know that, whatever his name, he is assuredly someone. I did not. On the contrary, it seemed to me that if I was not Goliath, then I must be no one at all. Though the stranger had never laid eyes on me before that day, I didn't doubt for a moment that he spoke with an unquestionable authority. A thousand others had called me by the name of Goliath, even those who, like the workers at the menagerie, knew me well, but that was clearly not the point, counted for nothing. The stranger hadn't said, your name is not Goliath. He had said, you are not Goliath. There was a world of difference. As I felt it, though I could not have expressed it this way at the time, my awareness of selfhood had been pronounced a delusion. I drifted into a sort of fugue state, neither aware nor unconscious. An attendant came round with food, but I ignored him. Night fell, but I didn't sleep. The rain stopped, and the sun rose without my noticing. Soon, there were the usual crowds of visitors calling out, Goliath! 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 But I paid no attention. Several days passed in this way. Then one evening, after the menagerie had closed for the day, I took a long drink from my bowl and soon fell asleep. A powerful sedative had been added to my water. At dawn, I awoke in an unfamiliar cage. At first, because it was so large and so strangely shaped, I didn't even recognize it as a cage. In fact, it was circular and open to the air on all sides. As I later understood, a gazebo had been modified to serve the purpose. Except for a large white house nearby, it stood alone in the midst of an attractive park that I imagined must extend to the ends of the earth. It was not long before I had conceived an explanation for this strange translocation. The people who visited the menagerie came, at least in part, with the expectation of seeing a gorilla named Goliath. How they came to have this expectation, I could not guess, but they certainly seemed to have it. And when the owner of the menagerie learned that I was, in fact, not Goliath, he could scarcely go on exhibiting me as such, and so had no real choice but to send me away. I didn't know whether to be sorry about this or not. My new home was far more pleasant than anything I'd seen since leaving Africa, but without the daily stimulation of the crowds, it would soon become even more excruciatingly boring than the zoo, where at least I'd had the company of other gorillas. I was still pondering these matters when, around mid-morning, I looked up and saw that I was not alone. A man was standing just beyond the bars, blackly silhouetted against the sunlit house in the distance. I approached cautiously and was astonished to recognize him. As if reenacting our former encounter, we gazed into each other's eyes for several minutes. I sitting on the floor of my cage, he leaning on his walking stick. I saw that, dry and freshly dressed, he was not the elderly person I'd first taken him for. His face was long and dark and bony. His eyes burned with a strange intensity, and his mouth seemed set in an expression of bitter mirth. At last he nodded exactly as before and said, "Yes, I was right. You are not Goliath. You are Ishmael. Once again, as if everything that mattered was now finally settled, he turned and walked away. And once again, I was thunderstruck, but this time by a feeling of profound relief, for I had been redeemed from oblivion. More, the error that had caused me to live as an unwitting impostor for so many years had been corrected at last. I had been made whole as a person, not again, but for the very first time. I was consumed with curiosity about my Savior. I didn't think to associate him with my removal from the menagerie to this charming Belvedere, for I was as yet incapable of even that most primitive of fallacies. Post hoc, ergo proper hoc. He was to me a supernal being. To a mind ready for mythology, he was the beginning of what is meant by godlike. He had twice made a brief appearance in my life, and twice, with a single utterance, had transformed me. I tried to search for the underlying meaning of these appearances, but found only questions. Had this man come to the menagerie in search of Goliath, or in search of me? Had he come because he hoped I was Goliath, or because he suspected I was not Goliath? How had he so promptly found me in my new location? I had no measure of the extent of human information. If it was common knowledge that I could be found at the menagerie, as it had seemed to be, it was also common knowledge that I could now be found here. Despite all these unanswerable questions, the overwhelming fact remained that this uncanny creature had twice sought me out in order to address me in an unprecedented way, as a person. I was certain that, having finally settled the matter of my identity, he would vanish from my life forever. What more was there for him to do? Doubtless you will have surmised that all these breathless apperceptions were just so much moonshine. Nonetheless, the truth, as I later learned it, was not much less fantastic. My benefactor was a wealthy Jewish merchant of this city, a man by the name of Walter Sokolov. On the day he discovered me at the menagerie, he'd been out walking in the rain in a kind of suicidal gloom that had descended on him a few months before, when he learned beyond any doubt that his entire family had been swallowed up in the Nazi Holocaust. His wanderings led him to a carnival set up at the edge of town, and he went in with nothing in particular on his mind. Because of the rain, most of the booths and rides were shut down, giving the place an air of abandonment that accorded well with his melancholy. At last, he came to the menagerie, whose chief attractions were advertised in a series of lurid paintings. One of these, more lurid than the rest, depicted the gorilla Goliath, brandishing the broken body of an African native as if it were a weapon. Walter Sokolov, perhaps thinking that a gorilla named Goliath was an apt symbol for the Nazi giant that was then engaged in crushing the race of David, decided it would be satisfying to behold such a monster behind bars. He went in, approached my wagon, and by gazing into my eyes, soon realized that I was no relation to the bloodthirsty monster in the painting, and indeed, no relation to the Philistine tormentor of his race. He found it gave him no satisfaction whatever to see me behind bars. On the contrary, in a quixotic gesture of guilt and defiance, he decided to rescue me from my cage and fashion me into a dreadful substitute for the family he had failed to rescue from the cage of Europe. The owner of a menagerie was agreeable to a sale. He was even glad to let Mr. Sokolov hire away a handler who had looked after me since my arrival. The owner was a realist. With America's inevitable entrance into the war, traveling shows like this were either going to spend the duration in winter quarters or simply become extinct. After letting me settle in for a day in my new surroundings, Mr. Sokolov returned to begin to make my acquaintance. He wanted the handler to show him how everything was done, from mixing my food to cleaning my cage. He asked him if he thought I was dangerous. The handler said I was like a piece of heavy machinery. Dangerous not by disposition, but by dint of sheer size and power. After an hour or so, Mr. Sokolov sent him away, and we gazed at each other in a long silence, as we had already done twice before. Finally, reluctantly, as if surmounting some daunting interior barrier, he began to speak to me, not in the jocular way of visitors to the menagerie, but rather as one speaks to the wind or to the waves crashing on a beach, uttering that which must be said, but which must not be heard by anyone. As he poured out his sorrows and self-recriminations, he gradually forgot the need for caution. By the time an hour had passed, he was propped up against my cage with a hand wrapped around a bar. He was looking at the ground, lost in thought, and I used this opportunity to express my sympathy, reaching out and gently stroking the knuckles of his hand. He leaped back, startled and horrified, but a search of my eyes reassured him that my gesture was as innocent of menace as it seemed. Alerted by this experience, he began to suspect that I was possessed real intelligence, and a few simple tests were enough to convince him of this. Having proved that I understood his words, he leaped to the conclusion, as others were later to do in working with other primates, that I should be able to produce some of my own. In short, he decided to teach me to talk. I will pass over the painful and humiliating months that followed. Neither one of us understood that the difficulty was insurmountable, owing to a lack of basic phonic equipment on my part. In the absence of that understanding, we both labored on under the impression that the knack would someday magically manifest itself in me if we persevered. But at last there came a day when I couldn't go on, and in my anguish at not being able to tell him this, I thought him this, with all the mental power I possessed. He was stunned, as was I, when I saw that he'd heard my mental cry. I won't burden you with all the steps of our progress once full communication was established between us, since they are easily imagined, I believe. Over the next decade, he taught me all he knew of the world and the universe and human history, and when my questions went beyond his knowledge, we studied side by side. And when my studies carried me beyond his own interests, at last he cheerfully became my research assistant, tracking down books and information and places that were, of course, beyond my reach. With the new interest of my education to absorb my attention, my benefactor soon forgot to torment himself with remorse, and so gradually recovered from his gloom. By the early 60s, I was like a house guest who needed very little attention from his host. So Mr. Sokoloff began to allow himself to be rediscovered social in social circles, with the not unpredictable result that he soon found himself in the hands of a young woman of 40 who saw no reason why he could not be made into a satisfactory sort of husband. In fact, he was not at all averse to marriage, but he made a terrible mistake in anticipation of it. He decided that our special relationship should be kept a secret from his wife. It was not an extraordinary decision for those times, and I was not sufficiently experienced in such matters to recognize it for the error it was. I moved back into the gazebo as soon as it had been renovated to accommodate the civilized habits I'd acquired. From the first, however, Mrs. Sokoloff viewed me as a peculiar and alarming pet and began agitating for my speedy removal or disposal.
Matt, we have to take a break from this now. But that's a good point to break. So this is very fascinating. So the gorilla is telling the whole story on how he is learning to be human, then how he learned to communicate, and then how he learned to knowledge, just basic knowledge of the world. Fascinating.
Very interesting so far.
So we'll have to pick up next time because my co-host Paulette is in studio, and I want to give Paulette a chance to say hello and join us in our conversation. Hello, Paulette.
Hello, Catherine. Hello, Matt.
Hi.
I'm glad I made it here.
Yeah, it's one of those days, I guess.
It is.
Things go the way they are. So, were you at your dance class?
Indeed, I was. And a fabulous time was had by me. And
excellent.
It's a wonderful way to spend the summer.
Learning to dance. So that means that at some point you're going to take it into the public domain and go out dancing. And
you never know.
Might happen.
Anything is possible.
Very good. So what do you think of Ishmael, what you heard of it so far?
It's a very powerful story.
Did you hear the reading last week?
Part of it.
Okay. Into the mic, Matt.
Oh, did you hear the reading last week? Or part of it, you said?
Part of it.
Okay.
But it's a very powerful and, I think, a very sort of spiritual story. That's how I relate to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, the subtitle here is An Adventure of the Mind and Spirit.
There we are.
So you're right on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because it sort of makes, I guess if a person woke up one day with amnesia and had to start again, except that the person might be able to speak, it's almost like starting with a blank slate with the main character being an animal, a gorilla. But it's interesting because it does make me wonder how much an animal can be cultivated and really learn to be a human being or to learn to communicate on a high level. So I have cats, probably not as smart as a gorilla, but it's amazing to me how well they can communicate. And it's amazing to me how specific their communication is. You know, and I've always had animals, but I learned the level of their communication because I have two cats. And I didn't, this was the first time I've ever had two of the same species. And I would watch them communicate with each other. And I begin to realize how much of their behavior is communication and how different their facial expressions are. I figured a cat's face is a cat's face, right?
Oh, my.
But no.
Wow.
They have all these facial expressions, and their eyes, they don't just change from, you know, light to dark. When, you know, when they're in the light, they're very bright. When they're in the dark, they look black. But you could also see different levels penetrating of soul and communication. So on one level, a cat's eyes will be very distant. But at another point, a cat's eyes are very, very loving. And so I didn't realize, and there's a very definitive difference where you could see an expression in their face of frustration. You can see if they're ticked off at you. You can see, and then they communicate. They have all these different sounds and behaviors, or, you know, tapping or clawing, and every single thing is actually a language. It's a word. I was amazed when I began to really see. And so it's at the point now that I communicate with them almost like they're human beings. And I thought that was, and it's very fascinating to me that I've always loved animals. I've always loved cats. And I've always known that dogs understood language. But people have said that because cats are aloof, that they don't really, you know, communicate in that way. But they also have a complete comprehension of language. It's really interesting. It's just that they speak a different language. So if you can communicate with them on a level that of understanding what their language means, then you can really relate to a cat like a person. And I suspect that there are many animals who are like this. It's just, and it may be a consequence of being domesticated. I'm not sure that a cat in the wild would be the same, or there'd be the same level of interspecies communication. But domestic animals who grow up with humans as their parents, really, when you think about it, have a way of really communicating on a human level. It's just that they don't have the language skills, the language capacity. But I feel that they're very, very intelligent and very communicative. I was really surprised. When I got my cats, they were very little kittens. You know, they could fit inside my sneaker. They were so little. And, you know, now they're kind of big cats. But, you know, so we've had this relationship as they grew older, and once I began to realize that they communicate to each other on a very sophisticated level,
wow,
I began to use their language to communicate with them, and so now we talk. It's interesting.
Wow.
That's reminiscent of a book I just finished reading recently by a Farley Mowat. He was like a naturalist. Mm-hmm. He was hired by the government to study wolves in the Arctic, you know, Canadian Arctic region. And it's very interesting how he starts out. You know, he's taught wolves, they're dangerous, and he's got all these supplies that he's given, a revolver, a rifle, something called wolf getters, which deliver a charge of potassium cyanide to any animal that investigates them. So he goes into the wild all prepared. You know, the caribou population is declining because the savage wolves are devouring them. When he gets there and starts observing them, he sees piling, comes upon a lair, and sees them, and he comes back the next day, and he stays there for hours. He's watching the lair. They don't show up. He's watching and watching. Then he turns around, and they have been watching him for hours all this time. And gradually, he learns that the caribou population was declining because of hunters and trackers. And what were the wolves living on, if not caribou? Well, he finds that there are these field mice by the dozens that they get. And he learns, he meets up with an Eskimo people, and they teach him. They are amazing. They are in tune with the environment. And they look at him like he's an alien or something when they realize he knows nothing about wolf behavior. And they teach him. And then he begins to discern the sounds of the wolves. They are communicating the subtle differences in their cries. And one of the Eskimos, a gentleman by the name of Utek, "Are the wolves are telling us other settlers are coming, other men are coming." He actually understands this, the language. And sure enough, they show up. And gradually he learns what's going on. Mm-hmm. And he has to report. He has to give the government the report what they want to hear. They don't want to hear that it's hunters and trackers that are decreasing the caribou population. And he's showing, they take him and show him how wolves and caribou live in harmony. Yes, they will find a weak one and they will have it for dinner. But any caribou, healthy caribou, can outrun any wolf. And the wolves know this. So mostly they don't even try. But the Eskimos are telling them it's the wolf that keeps the caribou strong, because they will occasionally test the caribou by running after one of them. And the caribou will just outrun him, and then the wolf will abandon the chase. So in this wise, I guess they keep the caribou strong. Very interesting, the wild environment, how it works, the ecology behind this.
It's so true. You made me remember a video I saw that I really fell in love with. I'm going to play the audio for people. It's actually called How Wolves Change Rivers, and it talks about the integration of the environment. So let's see if we can get this to play, and hopefully it's enough audio.
One of the most exciting scientific findings of the past half century has been the discovery of widespread trophic cascades. A trophic cascade is an ecological process which starts at the top of the food chain and tumbles all the way down to the bottom. And the classic example is what happened in the Yellowstone National Park in the United States when wolves were reintroduced in 1995. Now, we all know that wolves kill various species of animals, but perhaps we're slightly less aware that they give life to many others. Before the wolves turned up, they'd been absent for 70 years, that the numbers of deer, because there was nothing to hunt them, had built up and built up in the Yellowstone Park, and despite efforts by humans to control them, they'd managed to reduce much of the vegetation there to almost nothing. They'd just grazed it away. But as soon as the wolves arrived, even though they were few in number, they started to have the most remarkable effects. First, of course, they killed some of the deer, but that wasn't the major thing. Much more significantly, they radically changed the behavior of the deer. The deer started avoiding certain parts of the park, the places where they could be trapped most easily, particularly the valleys and the gorges. And immediately those places started to regenerate. In some areas, the height of the trees quintupled in just 6 years. Bare valley sides quickly became forests of aspen and willow and cottonwood. And as soon as that happened, the birds started moving in. The number of songbirds and migratory birds started to increase greatly. The number of beavers started to increase because beavers like to eat the trees. And beavers, like wolves, are ecosystem engineers. They create niches for other species. and the dams they built in the rivers provided habitats for otters and muskrats and ducks and fish and reptiles and amphibians. The wolves killed coyotes, and as a result of that, the number of rabbits and mice began to rise, which meant more hawks, more weasels, more foxes, more badgers. Ravens and bald eagles came down to feed on the carrion that the wolves had left. Bears fed on it too, and their population began to rise as well, partly also because there were more berries growing on the regenerating shrubs. And the bears reinforced the impact of the wolves by killing some of the calves of the deer. But here's where it gets really interesting. The wolves changed the behavior of the rivers. They began to meander less. There was less erosion. The channels narrowed. More pools formed. More riffle sections, all of which were great for wildlife habitats. The rivers changed in response to the wolves. And the reason was that the regenerating forests stabilized the banks so that they collapsed less often, so that the rivers became more fixed in their course. Similarly, by driving the deer out of some places and the vegetation recovering on the valley sides, there was less soil erosion because the vegetation stabilized that as well. So the wolves, small in number, transformed not just the ecosystem of the Yellowstone National Park, this huge area of land, but also its physical geography.
Amazing, right?
Where'd you get this?
It's Sustainable Human is the name of the organization that made that visible, How Wolves Change Rivers. And it's just remarkable to me that, you know, modern man is not so smart because the environment is really built to sustain itself in remarkable ways. Well, there's one more. It's also short. I'll play it for you. It's cute. It's how whales change climate.
One of the most exciting scientific findings of the past half century has been the discovery of widespread trophic cascades. A trophic cascade is an ecological process which starts at the top of the food chain and tumbles all the way down to the bottom. We all know that whales eat fish and krill, and some people, certain politicians in Japan, for instance, have argued that killing whales is good for human beings, as it boosts the food available for us to eat. And so you would think. But as the great whales declined, so did the numbers of fish and krill. It seems counterintuitive. Surely their numbers would rise as their major predators disappeared. But it now turns out that whales not only eat these animals, they also keep them alive. In fact, they help to sustain the entire living system of the ocean. Whales feed at depth in waters that are often pitch dark, and then they return to the surface, to the photic zone, where there's enough light for photosynthesis to happen. There they release what biologists call fecal plumes, vast outpourings of poo, poonamis. These plumes are rich in iron and nitrogen, nutrients which are often very scarce in the surface waters. And these nutrients fertilize the plant plankton that lives in the only place where plants can survive, the photic zone. Fertilizing the surface waters isn't the only thing the whales do. By plunging up and down through the water column, they also keep kicking the plankton back up into the photic zone, giving it more time to reproduce before it sinks into the abyss. Even today, though whale populations have been greatly reduced,
the vertical mixing of water caused by movements of animals up and down through the column of the oceans is astonishingly roughly the same as the amount of mixing caused by all the world's wind and waves and tides. More plant plankton means more animal plankton on which the larger creatures then feed. In other words, more whales means more fish and krill. But the story doesn't end here, because plant plankton not only feeds the animals of the sea, it also absorbs carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. When eventually it sinks to the ocean floor, it takes this carbon out of circulation, down to a place where it remains for thousands of years. The more whales there are, the more plankton there is. The more plankton there is, the more carbon is drawn out of the air. When whales were at their historical populations, before great numbers of them were killed, it seems that they might have been responsible for removing tens of millions of tons of carbon from the atmosphere every year. Whales change the climate. The return of the great whales, if they're allowed to recover, could be seen as a benign form of geoengineering. It could undo some of the damage we've done, both to the living systems of the sea and to the atmosphere.
Like that, it almost makes me want to cry, because it's just so exquisitely beautiful, the harmony and the way the world is really designed to work, and it's all so interdependent. And here we are as a humanity blithely going on destroying, well, not we, but you know what I mean. It's interesting to know that there is this inherent harmony in the natural world.
That's the beauty of it.
Yeah.
It seems like no matter, you know, how many, for whatever intentions there are, no matter what damage humans can sort of cause on the planet, think, you know, 100 years from now, 200, 300, 500 years from now, somehow nature is going to find a way to bring itself back and balance itself out.
Well, I agree with that. Of course, speaking. Humanity may not be here, but that's another story. The planet can repeople itself. But I think that's one thing that's really important for us to think about and to look at. In terms of the world that we're living in, is when you hearken back to an age when there were more Aboriginal and Indigenous people on the planet, humanity was able to live in harmony with nature. Now, it may not have been as technologically efficient as we view our world today, but really, how valuable is all that technology? I'm not sure it is all that valuable. Do we really need the latest iPhone? I mean, isn't the one we had last year good enough? You know, in a way, it's like we have a lot of technology, but it's a false technology because everything is built to fail, built to, you know, to have a limited lifespan. And we live in such a disposable society that I think it gives us the false impression that we're actually making progress. From my perspective, technology could equally be in harmony with nature. It doesn't have to be such that it's so destructive to nature. And I think if you know, all of the things that you hear about in the environmental movement of moving away from fossil fuels, you know, moving into, you know, solar energy, wind energy, water energy. There are many, many ways, electricity, that we can move throughout the world and heat ourselves or cool ourselves without digging into the ocean and destroying the earth. So I think it's technology when its objective becomes to harmonize itself with nature is when humanity really will have evolved, from my perspective.
Well, I guess the whole thing, the whole issue is the whole issue is overconsumption. We just overconsume and built-in obsolescence. I mean, things are made so you can't fix them. Many, many years ago, you bought a radio. You could take it apart. You could see the components. You could fix it. You replaced this part, and it was good to go, and you used it again. You didn't throw things out so much. And that was a whole industry, repair service. Now, I look at things, you can't even get it apart the way it's sealed. You have to break it to take it apart. An example is the newer models of iPhones, even. The Samsung Galaxy, the S5, that one you could take the back off. So if you wanted to get another battery, it's easy to put in. The S6, it will not come off. You cannot. You have to take it to somebody. Mm-hmm. You know, if you wanted to get a new battery. So it's like things are made that way today. Very interesting.
Yeah, you're right. It's all about consumption and control. So that has a lot to do with what's going on and what's going wrong with our particular world, with our society, I think. Mm. Any thoughts?
Not any. I couldn't really add to what Matt just said.
Yeah, me either. Not really. It's pretty profound, Matt, when you think about it. But what's also very interesting, I find, is that people are disposable in everything, in their relationships, disposable in everything becomes very temporary. Jobs are temporary, careers are temporary, relationships are temporary. So we don't really communicate in depth in a way that I experience communication. It may be that there's a shorthand that people are using now that I don't get, sort of like I had to take time to learn how my cats speak. So maybe this whole texting generation is very in-depth. I just haven't learned that language. But it does feel like doesn't have the same depth of, you know, really conversing and talking and laughing. And I mean, and I'm sure all this still goes on. And it's just that from an outside observer, everyone seems very isolated to their communication device. So that even in groups, they're each still individually communicating through their devices, so that their attention on some level has to be divided between whom they're sitting with and whom they're communicating with on the phone. And I wonder if there is an impact for that, or if it's just normal because that's how people grew up.
I think that it's my opinion is that it has the same effect of one watching television on the news, mm-hmm. and hearing them make a big deal out of what's really a relatively inane sort of story.
Yeah.
So they'll dress it up or, you know, present it as if this is, you know, something that you should really listen to. Look, this cat is barking into the...
And it's not enough that they tell you once. It has to come up breaking news every few minutes, the same story.
Exactly. It's like, no, we want your attention here. and keep it here. And every time I sort of sit in a crowded place and I realize that everyone is detached from each other and everyone has out their device, it reminds me of that. It's like, you know, no, your attention should be here, you know, not with the people around you, not with the rest of the world, the physical world. It should be in this little electronic
device,
this little window, and that's where your attention should really be.
Well, you know, these phones are very restrictive and controlling, and you're right, they are designed to keep your attention. I have this new phone now, and I opened, I accessed my Facebook on the phone because I figured, hey, you know, it's a lot lighter to carry than a laptop. So I could do communication, but it's nuts because anytime anybody who is connected to my Facebook page does anything, I get a little beep on the phone. And I'm like, wow, I have to figure out how to turn this off. Because if I, like my Facebook page, because I'm communicating about the show and I'm communicating about my classes, I'm communicating. So I have all these levels of communication that I'm endeavoring, I should say. I don't know how successful to work through Facebook. So there's like 600, 700 people that have signed up into my Facebook account. Can you imagine that every time any one of those people makes even a post on their own page?
Hmm. Wow.
Not on my page, on their page, I get a little dee-dee-dee-dee-dee. I'm like, wow, really?
My goodness.
You have to hire a secretary.
Exactly.
Keep track of,
well, no, it's like
people.
I'm beginning to realize why people are so attached to their phones. The phones are designed to make sure that you hear everything, see everything, and then anyone who's concerned about missing something, which is like a different level of anxiety, would be, you know, very much attached to it. I'm quite different in that sense. It's like I actually want to miss that. You know, it's like because what I do is I go into Facebook. I have time today. I'll go into Facebook. I'll do some posts. I'll search stuff around and, you know, send friend requests, take friend requests. And I like it. It's a little bit intimidating because it is a tool of the NSA. But beyond that, it's fun. So I'm, you know, I'm wanting to be professional. So I'm like, let me do Facebook. And it's interesting because my family is on Facebook. I haven't spoken to a couple of my family members for years, and there they are on Facebook, and now we're like chatting back
wow.
and forth. So it's like, well, it does serve a role, but there is a level of hyper attachment that can happen, and I think that the devices are designed
sure.
to make sure that happens.
Sure.
It's kind of interesting.
Because of all the senses that it sort of stimulates, whether it's visual, whether it's what you hear,
mm-hmm.
the feel of it, the color of it.
Yeah, and the flashing and
absolutely.
The changing of the different images. It really is a multimedia device in your hand.
Yes.
And it's very easy because it's all there. The news is there. The you know, the weather, everything is there. It's fascinating.
Well, it can become a major addiction. It really can. I mean, I have a friend who had a computer and he got rid of it. He says, I just couldn't get away. I was on the internet and I just couldn't get. I used to have a clock to time myself,
mm-hmm.
and even that didn't work. So he just had to get off of it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I could see how that. I mean, I think I've experienced that. Probably not to the level of many, but there, it's a great filler for boredom.
Sure.
So I could see how that could happen, but I think there is a lot to be said for getting back to nature, for being in real nature, sitting with trees, feeling, because there's an energy that comes out of nature that's very positive, that's very calming and very healing. And I believe that the same is true in human-to-human interactions. You know, there's a sharing of the heart, there's a sharing of mind, and there's stimulation in a different way that feels much more harmonious, assuming the people are being harmonious with each other. That is very, very healthy. And I think that we need that as a human race so that we can elevate ourselves to the level of nature. Obviously, nature is much more advanced than humanity on so many levels. They don't have the same language capacity, but on every other level, I believe that humanity needs to catch up with the natural world in order to continue to live on the planet. And so I think that's all a part of, we started out playing a little bit of Greg Braden talking about the shifting that's happening in our world. And he was speaking from a couple of years ago. But now we can really see it also in the weather. You know, there's so much going on that's shifting the world. And we are like fleas on the back of Earth. And I'm hoping that we can have an impact in the political discourse so that we can preserve our lives as well as the planetary life. We're just about out of time. Any final love or message or good nights you would love to send to our listeners, Matt?
Well, as you're going to see, as in this book, Ishmael, he gets into these very issues. And there are some very interesting dialogues that cover just what you're talking about. We have a lot to look forward to it. By the way, hello to a erstwhile volunteer who called me up the other night and said he heard me. And hello, Jeff. How you doing, Governor?
Excellent. Paulette?
Well, I guess having spent quite a bit of time this evening dancing salsa with a really good teacher, I'm always reminded of how much life actually is a dance.
Mm.
And how much, you know, your interactions with people, you know, it has a certain rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
And people play certain roles, and sometimes you switch roles and or direction, and you know, it's nice to be reminded that, you know, as you're talking about human interaction, that there's a very important aspect of it that is indeed a dance, hopefully not a destructive one.
Yeah, well, I think that's a very good point. I see that very much. And I just want to, my final word is to remind everyone, do a little PR here. I've been teaching a mind-body practice about, you know, integrating mind, body, and spirit on Saturdays from 2 to 3 p.m. at Studio Maya in Brooklyn. And it will only continue, I think there's like 3 more weeks, till the 30th of July. Saturdays from 2 to 3 p.m. You're welcome to drop in and join me for the class. There is a tuition donation suggested. We could find out more about that, but it's not a lot. We have to pay and maintain the space. And it's based on the Qigong practice, which is a graceful interplay of breath, meditation, and movement designed to cultivate inner peace and activate your innate healing capacity. So it's a way of healing, recharging, and moving forward. On Saturdays at 2, Studio Maya is 603 Bergen Street in Brooklyn, between Carlton and Vanderbilt Avenues. If you're interested, you can drop by or give a call, 347-480-1694, 347-480-1694, or you can send an email about this or any other questions to heartofmindradio@gmail.com. So I want to thank you very much for joining us today, and please do stay tuned for Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund. And this is Makote by Madeka from African Groove. Quelle est-ce que sans moi quand tu lis ou bien challenge nous les ni metti mon paquet ni me commence à ti oh aniela wa ici ni oh aniela wa oh uni oh aniela wa ici ni oh aniela wa oh uni yeah yeah maka 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 te maka 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 te maka 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 te ile maka 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 te maka 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 te maka 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 te ile tike tike sans moi quand ton lit va bien challenge nous vieux ni metti mon paquet ni me commence à tine tike tike sans moi quand ton lit va bien challenge nous vieux ni wa ni metti mon paquet ni me commence à tine oh aniela wa ici ni oh aniela wa oh uni oh aniela wa ici ni maka 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 te maka 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 te ile maka 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 te maka 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 te maka 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 te ile.
Envole-toi, belle hirondelle, petite sœur fragile, va et sois agile. Gare au cœur sans scrupule, rossignol à la promesse facile. Ton besoin d'amour n'y trouvera pas l'exil, pas même une presqu'île. Ce que tu fais, je l'ai fait, et entre mille et mille autres méfaits. Méfaits à ta guise, tu finiras bien par apprendre qu'il y a plus à donner qu'à prendre. Comme toi, je m'étais bâti des toits d'azur, des rêves sur mesure. La liberté est belle, mais la folie peut saboter sa beauté. Tu n'imagines pas ce que le plaisir peut coûter. Tes escarpins seront toujours de paille si ton prince n'est pas de taille. Tu n'es pas à mon côté quand t'es à mes côtés.
Thank you. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and, oh yes, the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With us this morning, artist, director,
movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. The new French animated film Phantom Boy teeters on the edge of being a keen observation on the resilience of childhood, but never quite goes over. The Phantom Boy of the title is Leo, a young child with the ability to loose his spirit from the confines of his body, allowing it to roam the streets and towers of a present-day New York at will. He uses this power to help a police detective confined to a wheelchair in a hospital track down and foil the plans of a colorfully disfigured master cyber criminal, Leo being aided in his efforts on the corporeal plane by an intrepid female reporter, who's also a love interest for the detective, of course. The reason why Leo meets the detective is that he's hospitalized, too. He's undergoing chemotherapy, his superpower having manifested itself with the diagnosis of his illness, never specified, but presumably cancer. Where Phantom Boy most captivates is when directors Alain Gagnol and Jean-Louis Felicioli triangulate between the reality of Leo's condition, presented with admirable candor, the sense of liberation his power grants him. The film's most powerful moments come as the disembodied Leo impassively observes his parents comforting each other, and a scene that turns the old children can see things we can't cliche on its head in the most heart-rending way possible, and how that courage then steals him in his crime-fighting exploits. But Phantom Boy is meant above all to be a fun, kid-centric adventure, much in the vein of Gagnol's and Felicioli's previous outing, A Cat in Paris. And so the directors have decided, perhaps more than is absolutely necessary, to go easy on the more emotionally challenging aspects of their story, causing some problems with what is supposed to be an especially affecting moment at the end. But the film, by and large, is fun. The design is beautiful and inventive. 2D world that takes its cue from the skewed perspectives of Chagall, with a bit of Picasso thrown in for the dislocated features of the bad guy. And it is a rush to see contemporary New York transformed into Gagnol's and Felicioli's colorful palette. Phantom Boy could have been more, but it's still a fine adventure. Documentary director Michael Valentine attempts to capture the breadth and width of the comic book industry in comics beyond the comic book pages. That's a pretty tall order, and Valentine gets a bit lost in trying to fulfill it, attacking, as this film does, the history of comic books, spotlighting some of its prominent personalities. Stan Lee is there, of course, Frank Miller, Todd McFarlane, Neil Adams, etc. delving into the evolution of indie publishers, exploring fandom, and addressing the present-day economic struggles the industry is going through. If you haven't been following the field, it is a good overview, if a bit overambitious. If you're already a fan, it is a fun watch, but I'm not sure anything will be revealed that you don't already know. It's making its home video debut next week, and that title, by the way, is spelled C-O-M-I-X, Beyond the Comic Book Pages, apparently because no one ever thought anyone would be reviewing this movie on the radio. More focused in its subject matter is Out of Time, Saving the DeLorean Time Machine, which is also out now on home video. Director Steve Concatelli takes us behind the scenes of the restoration of the original DeLorean Time Machine from the Back to the Future franchise. Time, ironically, has not been kind to the vehicle, and Concatelli ably catalogs the ravages done to it over its life on screen and in theme parks, brings in, as a passionate advocate, one of the people who chaperoned the vehicle in the guise of Doc Brown during its theme park days, and documents the one-year, sometimes emotionally devastating restoration process performed by effects expert Joel Walzer and a largely volunteer team. This, admittedly, is subject matter for a specialized audience, and I, for better or worse, am among those who relished every second watching Walzer and team root through military supply stores and junk shops for just the right replacement wires and meters, and struggling to get the curvature of the aluminum time deflectors just right. Out of Time, Saving the DeLorean Time Machine is nerd porn, frankly. In other words, I loved it immensely. And remember, the Monster Channel is now available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It just doesn't stop. You can watch it by downloading the Monster Channel app on your Roku device, or by setting your browser or iOS device to monsterchannel.tv. The Monster Channel. Come scream with us. I'm Dan Persons. Now is the time to take a stand against hatred, fear, and greed. Register to vote, and let's defeat Trump.
That was his Trump card, you see. The Monster Channel segueing into Trump. I mean, there's something just so appropriate about that. I don't even know where to begin, other than to say hello and good morning. First of all, thank you, Ken Gale, for filling in last week while I was gallivanting, if that's what it is that I do, at ReaderCon. I had a lovely time, and my voice hasn't recovered yet, as you may be able to hear. I went up real early. ReaderCon actually begins like late Thursday evening. But I went up Wednesday because the drive was nice, the day was nice. And then I can spend Thursday during the day bird watching.
It's totally impossible to gallivant and bird watch at the same time. I'm sorry.
I gallivanted too there. And then bird watched after the gallivant.
You gallivant to the birds?
Yeah. And then you stop gallivanting and you stealth around. You don't have to stealth that much because the birds come to you. And en route, always stop off every year. There's a particular restaurant called the Traveler's Book Restaurant.
Oh, and, appropriate.
And they have books all around, and you can take, for every meal you buy, you can just take 3 books. I more often bring books nowadays and take books from there.
Because you're that kind of person.
I've got books, and you know, people can take them, and they circulate that way. But also, they've got birds. They've got great birds there.